Everyone has a story. How they got here, where they met along the way, the choices they made, the dreams they are chasing. Welcome to Anthologies of Hope. Welcome back to Anthologies of Hope, and thank you all so much for joining us week to week. It means the world to both myself and all the guests when we get the great and uplifting feedback from each of our episodes. As always, I'm your host, Rick Osowski, and I'm not a mental health professional in any way, simply a mental health advocate with a passion for storytelling. Make sure to keep an eye out for both our regular weekly interviews for Season 2, as well as all the additional bonus content we have coming from the Conversations Cafe event series hosted at Sip of Hope Coffee Bar right here in Chicago. Make sure to check out their Facebook page of either Hope for the Day or Sip of Hope to keep an eye out for all the upcoming Conversations Cafe events in 2019. Picking up where we left off with our traditional episode format from last season, we're continuing our interviews with members of the HeartCamp family. If you're not familiar with HeartCamp, we dive deep into the ins and outs of it in our first two episodes, but as a quick refresher, HeartCamp is the brainchild of Jamie Korkowski and a two-day workshop focusing on authenticity, writing, bringing your heart to work, and mental health. If you've been listening to Anthologies of Hope, you know it's so much more. For more info on HeartCamp, including upcoming dates like May 4th and 5th in Melbourne, Florida, you can check out heartcampwithjamie.com for details. Not only are we keeping the conversations rolling with our HeartCamp family, but more literally, my actual family, with my wonderful wife, Amanda Osowski, joining us this week. This was the first Anthologies of Hope interview with planned bathroom breaks since, as you'll hear, we recorded this episode on Christmas Day when Amanda was 16 weeks pregnant. Using that as a catalyst for her mental health journey, we do a deep dive into our joint IVF journey and what that experience has been like to be able to bring our daughter into the world, who is currently still baking very healthily at 30 weeks. It's a very unexpected parallel with our IVF journey and mental health journeys, and how many similarities there have been, and the presence and stigma of silence around them both. It's only fitting that we are releasing this episode so close to Trite Love in Our Arms' 13th birthday, and so soon after our actually planned baby shower here in Chicago. Trite Love in Our Arms has meant so much to Amanda's journey, so it was serendipitous but also ridiculously practical that both of these events happened on the same day. If not for Trite Love in Our Arms, there would not be an us, there would not have been a HeartCamp family, there would not be a baby O, and there would not have been HeartCamp family in town for our baby shower this past weekend. Also, there would not have been a complete surprise baby O baby shower at the HeartCamp reunion back in January that caught us totally off guard and pretty much still in shock from. It's no surprise that Amanda and I are almost overlapping in the Enneagram department. So for us to get taken care of by the HeartCamp family over and over again, it makes us feel really seen, valued, and heard as some of the hardest loving twos we know. I have to say, with no obligation whatsoever, that this is definitely my favorite episode to date. Not only to see Amanda take to the podcasting experience so easily, but I was also able to learn something that she never told me before. And based on how much we ever communicate, that is surprisingly impressive. Moving on to our Season 2 playlist, which will be available at anthologiesofhope.com/playlist, you will still be able to find our Season 1 playlist under our user account on Spotify, as well as anthologiesofhope.com/playlist-season-1. As you'll hear, Amanda chose not to play by the rules when answering some of our regular closing questions, so I'm going a little out of the way here for this week's song selections on my end as well. My main selection this week is Failure Anthem's Here for Good. Just one listen to this song will make you understand why it is such a powerful song in both our relationship and in our everyday lives. There is definitely a little homage to Kenneth's selection of Song for the Broken from Close Your Eyes earlier in Season 1, but there's just something about these songs that you find unexpectedly and then that are just left crying after you hear them because they are exactly what you needed to hear. Both of my other additions this week, The Somersets' Lightning in a Bottle and Death Cab for Cuties' I Will Follow You Into the Dark, both have had similar experiences for both of us, yet also, unsurprisingly, mean so much to many of our friends as well. All the songs we talk about this week are great additions to the Season 2 playlist. Each week, we'd like to remind you that if you're in a time of crisis, we will be covering a range of potentially difficult topics. Please use this as a warning to seek help and come back to listen once you are in a more positive season. If you are in need of help, an abundance of international resources can be found on the Find Help pages from Trite Love in Our Arms and Hope for the Day. Trite Love in Our Arms can be found at TWLOHA.com/find-help, and Hope for the Day can be found at HFTD.org/find-help. As always, you can find us at anthologiesofhope.com, on Facebook and Instagram as Anthologies of Hope, on Twitter as Anthologies Pod, or email us directly at anthologiesofhope, all one word, no punctuation, @gmail.com. Like, subscribe, and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and Google Podcasts. Here is this week's Anthologies of Hope interview, and according to many friends of the show, well overdue. My wife, Amanda Osowski.
Hello, So we're here this week with a very special Christmas Day episode recording. I'm sure that it will be both one of the funnier ones, as well as I think it's the first one that we've planned out bathroom breaks, because we're with my lovely wife, Amanda, who is
16 and a half weeks pregnant.
Excellent. And this is how we're choosing to spend our Christmas Day. It's been plenty of pancakes and Hallmark Christmas movies so far. Almost to a person, everybody that has listened to the podcast, we've met individually, we know, connected, real life, social media, asks us about our story, asks us how we met, how we got to where we are, what made us become mental health advocates. And so I'm very interested in figuring out exactly what we're doing there and kind of everything that we've got going on from our friends and family perspective, telling our stories, and then how that has empowered everybody else to get where they are today, both in mental health, depression, anxiety, suicide awareness, running pretty much the gamut there, and how we've had a couple amazing mental health organizations come into our lives over the course of our time here on Earth, not obviously just time together. So we're also in a new technical setup, since I usually record at my desk and the other person is at the other end of the line. But today we are here in our office / guest room with a portable mic setup. While I stop babbling and fail to introduce you, I'll let you go ahead and introduce yourself and then we'll go from there.
Hi guys, my name is Amanda. I'm sure some of you have heard of me. I'm really excited to be here today. Obviously, I've known Rick longer than anyone else listening. Rick and I met a while ago. Our meeting definitely coincided with my mental health journey, and it was at a time in my life when I most certainly was not looking for a boyfriend, let alone a husband or a new life. And you know, when you find someone who shares not only your views and your ideals, but who is amazingly supportive and wants to run with the same things and is passionate about the same things that you are, you know that you can't let them go. And here we are all these years later.
So a little part of what we'll talk about here is definitely going to be captured as part of our story, but we'll focus mostly on your story. And then it's not like we need to figure out a crossover here, but it will be something where we'll make sure to touch on enough of the joint story that we have together, how much of kind of the journey and Heart Camp has been a part of our story up until now, but then mostly focus on our backstory, where it kind of got to where we are, and more of the formative years of where we've gotten to today. So why don't we jump into the Wayback Machine and go into your early on mental health story and journey?
Sure.
And where that started, because with your journey so far, you've, similar to some of the other folks that we've talked on the podcast, you've also written a book detailing, whether you realize it or not, talks about mental health aspects inside there.
It does.
And then, you know, an extensive blogger, you're a very prolific writer in your own right.
Thank you.
And so it is something that whether it's been acknowledged or not, it's been something that has been part of your course to date. So
yeah,
there's been many events that happened way long back that have formed where you are today. So why don't we jump into some of your journey on the mental health spectrum and go from there?
Yeah, that sounds good. So really the first time that I remember kind of dealing with some things was when I was 15, within like 6 months time period, several major life events happened with me and with my family. The first real impactful death that I'd ever experienced happened in December of 2000. I was I was like 14 and a half, and my skating coach, who was like another parent to me, someone that I trusted and admired and looked up to and really believed in, he had a heart attack in his sleep at age 49 and just died suddenly. And within, you know, a handful of months of that, my mom's biological father passed away unexpectedly, and my parents' marriage started to crumble, and I experienced a rather intense figure skating accident. I used to skate competitively, and I had a great run-in with the boards, which cost me about 40 stitches in my mouth and 2 broken wrists and some severed nerves. But really just a handful of events happened in a very short amount of time that made me sort of realize that life was not rainbows and sunshine, and that, you know, people had stuff to deal with that was really, really hard. And, you know, I've always been a feeler, or like a feeling person, I guess, which is probably not a surprise to anybody who knows me. And I always like wanted to carry other people's problems, and so they didn't have to. You know, I remember even when I was like 10, 11 years old, and I'd be ice skating in a class, and if someone else fell down, I would apologize to them. Like, what? Okay, but that's like a great snapshot into who I am. So anyway, I was definitely not a stranger to mental health things, but really the day that my world sort of changed was April 10th of 2008. I lived in a sorority house with some really incredible women, and one of our friends and sisters took her life in the house that we lived in while we were asleep. And, you know, we were a month from graduation. I was a senior in college, and like life just stopped. And I mean, experiencing that kind of event in a bubble where you live with 50 other people who are as immensely affected as you are is just this very whirlwind type experience. And within a couple of days of that event, I had found Tori Love on her arms on MySpace and was just trying to figure out what to say to who and what to say to myself and how to sit with it. And maybe 2 weeks after that, it was the last week of classes in my senior year of college, and I was giving a presentation that I had been really anxious about. And towards the end of my presentation, all of a sudden, I saw stars. And I went to say to my professor, like, something isn't right. And I basically just like slid down the wall and passed out. And, you know, they called the ambulance and the paramedics. And it turns out that that was really my very first experience with a panic attack.
Oh, well, that's the first time I'm hearing about this. So maybe we'll end up getting into some deeper stuff here, too. So that's the first time I'd heard about that. So, yeah, well, and that's obviously not the best time to discover that in front of
35 people in your class. No, I mean, it was a cognitive neuroscience class, so at least people were interested.
What was going on?
Yep. But that was really like a heads up to me. And I mean, in my first couple of years of college, I had been on and off. I had had a couple of visits to like a therapist on campus, you know, mostly because of the events that I talked about previously, my parents' divorce and the several things that happened in a short period of time, you know, towards the end of high school had really affected me. And, you know, when you're away from home and you're living on your own, you start to kind of internalize some of those things and they manifest in other ways. As someone who has always been really like type A and very conscientious about like the persona she puts out into the world, like I feel like I mean, it's like, it sounds terrible, but like I pat myself on the back because I feel like I always had constructive ways to deal with my anxiety and my emotions. Like I was a hardcore straight A student. I was editor in chief of the yearbook in high school. I held several roles in my sorority in college. And
well, I think that's something where it'll come out in both of our stories, where that's very reflective of myself as well. But it's something where we believe, or we kind of have the personality trait where everything's going to work itself out if we just keep doing the right things and checking things off. And
yeah, I mean, I guess like my mentality was like charge ahead full speed and like be the shining star, so like no one realizes that stuff is wrong. Mm-hmm. But like, as an adult, like I have a couple of friends from that period of my life who are like, we're really surprised you didn't like do cocaine. Like, because there could have been, I could have had a lot of less constructive ways to deal with my feelings. And so I'm grateful that those weren't choices that I made at the time, you know. And then after I graduated college, I obviously was still very affected by the loss of my friend. It was my first direct experience with suicide and it was very impactful. And about a little over a year after her death, I walked in the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention's Out of Darkness Overnight Walk, which was hosted here in Chicago in 2009. It was 12 miles from, I'm sorry, it was 20 miles from dusk to dawn. And I raised $2,500 for the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. And also that's sort of that in that time period, I kind of dug my fingernails a lot deeper into like Jamie Tworkowski's writings and the messages of Tori Love on her arms. And really started just kind of carrying that message with me. Coincidentally or not, about 4 months after that, I got, well, what we refer to in my life is I got sick. I started having a lot of trouble with like my GI system. I was in and out of the hospital. I was rapidly losing weight. I was really, really miserable. And despite seeing some relatively good doctors and undergoing several tests, it was years before anyone figured out what the actual problem was. And that really changed me. It changed my perspective on life. And it really, to be honest, like led me to the darkness. It really impacted my mental health because, well, first off, when you can't eat for like months and months and months on end, like life's a bitch. But no doctor seemed to know how to help me. And there seemed to be no chance of it getting better. There seemed to be no light at the end of the tunnel. People, you know, doctors were saying like it's in your head or it's anxiety or you have an eating disorder. And obviously I knew none of these things were true, but I just felt like no one believed me. I felt invisible. I felt really, really vulnerable. And, you know, I had been working with a like specific GI psychologist who had a decent working relationship with for a short period of time. And then basically the easiest way to like explain it is like she dumped me. Like she dumped me with no warning and with no referral. And I felt really distraught.
Which unfortunately, and I can't remember if it's conversations we've had that have aired or just recorded or casually with other friends, that seems to happen more often than I'd ever expect.
Which is crazy because it's so unethical.
Exactly.
And I had reached out to a friend of mine who she had inflammatory bowel disease. She had Crohn's disease. And so I had known her from like the GI space. And she also was becoming a therapist. And I asked, I said, I really need a recommendation. And this girl, trust me, I thank her probably once a year because she connected me to my current therapist, who is like a human with wings. And I've been with my current therapist now more than 5 years. And just it couldn't be a better match. Like I'm so, so, so lucky and grateful. And granted, she's probably like the 8th therapist that I've seen. But I started working with her in September of 2013 when I was not in a good place. I was really depressed and I was having a lot of anxiety and I was already on an antidepressant. I was already taking Prozac. You know, it had been managed by my primary care doctor up until that point. But within like a month and a half, 2 months of working with my current therapist, I had to be honest with her and I had to say like, I'm having suicidal ideations. Like I don't see my life getting better and therefore I don't see a reason to stay. And she was incredibly efficient. She did not take it lightly, not for any second. And she was like, you need more than what we can do in this room right now. And that was, I mean, I was already seeing her twice a week at that point, but she referred me to what was called an IOP or an intensive outpatient program. And so I started the IOP on December 16th of 2013. So we just passed the 5-year mark of that. And I was petrified. But basically the IOP I experienced was a group setting. So there was anywhere from maybe 15 to 30 people at a time in the room, anywhere from age 18 to age 65 or 70. And it was a combination of group therapy and individual therapy, of cognitive behavioral therapy and dialectical behavioral therapy. There was a psychiatrist on the practice who worked with adjusting our meds. There was a career counselor. There was a family therapist. And there were just a lot of pieces. There was art therapy and music therapy and sort of a lot of ways to try to grow your toolbox so you could hopefully walk out of that room feeling more able to handle life's challenges than when you started. And I actually ended up, I spent 14 weeks there and I was there pretty much 5 days a week, 14 weeks straight. You know, it's definitely longer than some other people. I had the luxury or the privilege, I guess, of I wasn't working at the time. I was still in grad school and I was able to, you know, I was living at home at the time and I didn't have financial responsibilities that were preventing me from staying in treatment. And so that really was probably one of the most radical and like moving and changing experiences that I've had. And, you know, it's been interesting, like, you know, last week when we passed the 5-year anniversary, you know, you and I did some reflecting on how different my life is and how different my mentality is and the things that have happened since then that have reinforced it. And it just, so that experience especially is one where like I was pulling from Trey Love and Harms every single day. I was pulling quotes into that room. I was pulling blog posts into that room. I was sharing them with other people in that room. And this was the year, I think it was right around the time, I think it was 2013 when Heavy and Light went on the road, and I was able to see Heavy and Light here in Chicago at the House of Blues, and that was just a monumental experience because I was still in this program 5 days a week, and I was in a space where I wasn't really sure if I wanted to stay. I was still feeling suicidal at times, and I was definitely depressed, and to be in a room where I was told that that was okay and that there was someone else feeling that way really grounded me, and it really gave me permission to say like, okay, this isn't mortifying. It happens to people. Like, how do we move forward? So yeah, I mean, that's a lot of information and a lot of pieces, but I feel like that has been really like the pillars of my mental health journey. And since then, I mean, it took me, I would say probably a year to 2 years after graduating from the program, that I was really just trying to like stay on my own path and stay, keep my head above water. But you know, you and me, our paths crossed, and we definitely made a stronger team than I was as an individual. And somewhere over, you know, after about a year, year and a half out of the program, I realized that it was really important to me to speak up about my experience because I wanted to help get rid of some of the stigma around mental health. And, you know, it's obviously, we'll talk about this later, but it's interesting how that mentality has kind of taken over my life and all of the things that could have stigma. But ever since then, like ever since probably like three and a half years ago, I feel like I have really taken as many opportunities as I can to share my story, to talk about mental health, to not only just be supportive to others, but really to provide resources whenever the opportunity is available. I mean, I'm sure that you've talked about it before, but I think crisis text line is one of the greatest things that exists. I have used crisis text line when I've been in crisis during the time that I was in this program and in the years since. And I keep like a screenshot on my phone of how people can get a hold of crisis text line. And that's like one of the first things that I send people who are in crisis or who are dealing with a lot of emotions, because it's something right then and there that they can do. It's not something that they have to wait or schedule or call. But I've realized for me that that's like, I need to feel constructive when I'm trying to be supportive. And so by saying like, here is a resource, here is a thing you can do, that makes me feel like maybe I'm helping someone in the ways that I was able to get help.
Jumping into or jumping back to the IOP program that you were in, it's very similar in nature description into some other IOP programs that we have other friends that have been participants in. But there are two interesting things that you mentioned there where it kind of aligns with some of the information that I've taken in lately, and a couple of weeks ago when our friend Amy, whose episode is going to come out this season as well, joined myself to go to a community train mental health and suicide prevention training put on by Hope for the Day. In all of our intros, we consistently advocate for, and is basically some of the extension of the Conversation Cafe content that we had in our season one bonus episode. But one of the notions there is there's kind of a icebreaker, although it's in the middle of the day, and interaction people moving program where we kind of moved around to figure out or guess or show by kind of population in the room the ages that we thought were the diagnosis of certain mental health conditions or treatment issues. And so one of the ones to me that was most interesting was the age of diagnosis of depression. And for the, I don't remember the exact governing body that they were using for the numbers there, but it was a national statistic for the US, but the number there for diagnosis of depression was 35.
Which is, I mean, and that's really interesting because when I think about it, like, I have definitely experienced episodes of depression going back to when I was 15, but I was not diagnosed with major depressive disorder until I was 27 and in this program.
And which is very interesting because tied into the other fact where you said you didn't have a job at the time, you had no major financial responsibility and things like that. So you would think that for a lot more IOPs and a lot of those programs, it tends to be high school students, college students, all of kind of younger adults. But you did mention in your group
Honestly, the makeup of my group, like the people who were younger than me, and so I was 27 when I was in this program, the people who were younger than me were far less than the people who were older than me. The age range skewed much higher. It almost seemed like a lot of kind of like midlife crisis situations, people in their 30s and 40s and 50s who either had recently retired or lost a job or lost someone they loved. And so, yeah, the demographic was definitely different than I think what a lot of people think of when they think about these programs.
Which is exactly what we're trying to do to break that stigma and figure out that these are things that you can use the entire court, not even can, but you should use the entire course of your life. These resources are out there.
Yeah, there's usually not an age maximum. Sometimes there's an age minimum, but the program that I did actually had a pediatric option. And so there was a different room in the same building. It was a very similar program, but there was a juniors group. And I think that was like ages maybe like 8 to 16 or 8 to 17. And that way, those individuals were put with people who they could relate to and not hearing necessarily the stories that were more difficult or unrelatable for them. So, I mean, I think that that's something I would definitely encourage is that I've never heard of a program that has a cap in terms of like you have to be under a certain age. And that was really inspiring for me to be like, you know, okay, I was 27 and I was like, shit, I don't have it all together. I don't have anything together. But then there were like grown-ups with kids who were like, oh, we don't either. Like, we need to figure this out. So, I mean, I think that that's a really good point too.
So let's fast forward a little bit from there and cycling through time. And as you said, you even like a year and a half out, you realized you had some of the tools at your disposal to basically deal with some of the issues that you were dealing with in a more constructive way or just in a more proactive way.
Yeah.
Which is great that we've kind of combined some of those tools for the necessity that we have in helping our friends, along with some of the tooling and both the resource information cards from both Hope for the Day and Torrent Love in Our Arms and things like that. In that fast forward, the kind of one of the next big pieces that we had in our joint experience came into the fact of over the course of your sickness and illness. And I don't know if when you were going through that, if you mentioned diagnosis as a Crohn's patient.
I did.
So this was...
I can provide some context on that. Rick brings up a good point. So in 2009, I became symptomatic with, you know, GI distress, and I basically was ill on and off through 2016. And I had been in North Carolina. Rick was packing up to move. And right after the new year, January 3rd or 4th of 2015, of 2016, we were going to get in the car and drive to Chicago with all of Rick's stuff. And the night before, we were in a movie theater and I had severe and sudden abdominal pain. Like, I couldn't breathe and I thought I was going to have to go to the emergency room in North Carolina. And we came back to Chicago, and within a week I was admitted here with my doctor. And after 9 days of tests and labs and all this stuff, I was finally diagnosed with Crohn's disease, which is an incurable autoimmune disease that can affect anywhere in the digestive tract from your mouth to your anus. My disease activity was all located in my small bowel, which is why it took 6.5 years to get diagnosed and why a lot of tests showed abnormalities, but not specific findings. And it took me another year, a little more than a year after being diagnosed, to get on the right treatment plan. So we tried several medications after I was diagnosed. And in March of 2017, I started an IV medication called Remicade, which has been the answer to all of my prayers and my biggest source of gratitude, because it really has given me my life back. But it took us a while to figure out the right dosage and frequency. You know, there's a lot of tinkering with that once you start, and it's very specific for your body. There's not a regular protocol. And while we were trying to figure that out, I experienced what we call like a disease flare. And I was really, really sick in September, about 3 weeks after our destination wedding. I was in the hospital for a couple of days, and we found out I wasn't absorbing. And
destination wedding, not foreign, so it wasn't anything major. It was just North Carolina.
No, we were still in America.
It wasn't anything like a foreign parasite or bacteria.
No. I'm way too neurotic for that to happen. And so, you know, we found out I wasn't absorbing a lot of the nutrients that I needed, and I was getting, you know, magnesium and potassium and calcium through IV. And I was in the hospital for pain control at that point. We were trying to figure out how we could manage this disease. And I actually, I was a victim of medical malpractice. I was overdosed on medication at a hospital that I had been at for years. A hospital that wasn't great. And we knew that there were a lot of shortcomings, but I loved my doctor and I had always felt safe. And this happened basically over a couple of days' time, but there's about 36 hours that I have no recollection of. Rick had to leave for a business trip, and while he was gone, I ended up being intubated and put on a ventilator because I had aspirated. I had basically vomited while unconscious, and fluid got caught in my lungs. And it was something that just obviously scared the ever-living daylights out of me. It caused significant diagnosed medical PTSD. You know that I was unable to sleep in our bed for months after that happened because it happened in a hospital bed. But that event really was basically soul shattering, but also rebuilding. The outpatient program that I did really did change my mentality and provide me a lot of tools. But even through 2016 and 2017, when things got really hard or really emotional or really frustrating, my mind still went to that place, I should just give up. I should just give up. A lot of times I felt like I was staying alive because of you, because you were here and I loved you and my love for you was more important than my love for myself or my wanting to stay alive. But when that event happened and when I kind of came out of the fog from that, I knew that I had basically been spared for a reason. I knew that I might not have made it through that event. I very possibly could have not begun breathing again on my own. And that was, I guess, a cross between a wake-up call and a calling and a purpose type feeling. Yeah. And I made a choice kind of within maybe a month of that. I made a choice that the old thought patterns were done. I wasn't ever going to let myself get to that place mentally again because I could have died and I didn't. And I realized I didn't actually want to, and that there were things I wanted to do with my life and someone I wanted to become. And that really I feel like the last piece of the puzzle for me in closing one door and opening the next. So I'm glad that you brought that up.
As a spectator, both participant and spectator in your life, I've definitely seen the switch there and the drive and the determination in how you attack problems as opposed to
letting them attack me.
You coexist with them or figure them out. So it ends up being a case where that type of event is not anything we're advocating for.
God, it was so traumatic.
But it is something where you having the perspective now, having the tools you had before where it was kind of keeping something at bay or just having it, abate and kind of sit there versus now having essentially overcome it and being something where you're proactively moving forward and just gaining ground from that being an element in the past where you know it's something that's there, but not something that is constantly, surrounded.
Well, and I think I want to be really mindful of how I phrase this because I know that it took me years to get to this place. But the thing that I think I feel most strongly about now is the element of choice. For a lot of years, I wanted the choice to end my life. I wanted to be in control and I wanted that to happen if and when I was ready and how I wanted it to happen. And then when the choice was almost taken away from me and I almost lost my life from something that wasn't my choice, I realized that my choice extended a lot more than just whether or not I was alive. My choices extended to what I did while I was alive, how I treated myself, what I accepted from other people. And I feel like that has been a huge driving factor in the last 14 months since this happened, is really on a daily or weekly basis, choosing what I'm going to allow in, what I'm going to allow to affect me. And I know that it's something that we talk about a lot and we say okay, what can we kind of release? What can we let go of? What can we move away from versus what can we control? How can we choose to take the path that feels right for your heart or your soul or your body or whatever? And that has been a really huge mindset shift for me. But please also understand that it's been 5, 6, 7 years in the making. I'm not saying to anybody who's listening, you have a choice, make it. please don't misinterpret that. Like, I'm saying the series of events in my life that occurred, plus the knowledge I had gained over that time, mm-hmm. led me to a place where I realized I could be using my choices a lot better in order to help myself.
It's any type of journey where it's the combination of activity plus events in your life. So physical health, going to the gym, and then running a 5K,
right.
You know, having those experiences, doing the work with a therapist, experiencing those programs, like all of that leads you to that penultimate choice where some folks may get that, some folks may not. So right. it's not something that's ever going to be one or the other.
Right. And I mean, I really am incredibly grateful to have arrived here. Yeah, I wish it could have happened differently. There's certainly things that I would have loved to not experience, but you know, and you know this firsthand because of the story of us, like sometimes I think that the worst things in your life have to happen to bring you to the best things in your life.
So let's jump forward now to the current conversation battle, stigma battle that we're in the middle of, that is frustrating, but also the most ultimately rewarding, and one that we found plenty of comedy in at the same time. Since we opened, and we're not bearing the lead, since we just got back from a pee break as well, where we are
pregnant.
But I don't know if it came up earlier in some of your story, but we did have to, or we are going through the IVF journey.
I don't think that I mentioned it. You know, I talked a lot about my health, and when we were ready to start trying to have a family, I was obviously, much to no one's surprise, very proactive. And, you know, we met with several doctors and we did genetic testing. And I wanted
in the context of your Crohn's conditions, yes, and things like that, yes, to be proactive to make sure everything was fine.
Yes. Right? I wanted to make sure that any of my current Crohn's medications or previous medications that I've been on or any of my health history wouldn't impact us having a safe pregnancy or a healthy baby. And we got, you know, the go ahead. We were told everything was fine and we could start trying to have a baby. And, you know, that was one of the most exciting, turned really difficult and almost devastating at times processes for me. Every single month, that negative pregnancy test was really emotional and my heart ached. All I've ever wanted is to be a mother, and that desire has increased so much since we've been together and since I have watched you with other kids. And about 8 or 9 months into our journey of trying to have a baby, and I mean, we were doing all of the regular things that you can do to, you know, increase your chances. I went to my lady doctor and, you know, asked her sort of what we could do or if there was anything else that we could add. And so she recommended actually that Rick get tested. You know, my tests up until that point had been normal. We hadn't done a ton of fertility testing. And so, you know, the gentleman's obligation of providing a sample was then analyzed. And while there wasn't anything wrong with it, some of the numbers were below average or towards the end of what is considered a healthy range. And that kind of pushed us into seeing a fertility specialist and Rick seeing a male specialist as well. And so in February of this year, so about 2.5 weeks after I went to heart camp this year, we met with a reproductive endocrinologist and we started a good 6 weeks of testing for both of us. Lots of personal testing. I'll spare you the details, but I'm happy to chat. If you're interested, please reach out to me. And we basically found out that we fell into a category called unexplained infertility. So if you failed to conceive naturally after 12 months and there are no blatant abnormalities in either the male or female anatomy or reproductive testing, then your inability to conceive is called unexplained. And so 1 in 8 couples experience infertility, and about 10% of those couples experience infertility for unexplained reasons. And so this sort of set a new path for us. And starting at the end of March through the end of July, we did several of what's a less invasive process. It's called IUI, or intrauterine insemination.
Which is basically the science of sex and just getting all the pieces and smashing them together.
Yeah, it's like assisted or like timed and basically assisted reproduction. And I had such high hopes that like, oh, we, you know, there's nothing wrong with us. And so this will push us over the finish line. And I was planning pregnancy announcements and due dates, and we failed. We failed four in a row. And that was, oh, that was really emotional and really hard and a lot of tears. And this year, so every 7 years, my birthday is on Mother's Day, including this year, 2018. And that was really hard for me to not be pregnant and to not know if we were going to be able to get pregnant. And in July, we started IVF. We did our consultation and all our learning in June, and we started the actual inductions in the process at the end of July. And during this whole time, starting, you know, back in February, I realized really quickly that there was, for me, what felt like as much stigma around infertility as there was around mental health. And I was shocked and then horrified and then pissed off, and then I was not having it. And so against maybe the advice of some of our family members or more reserved friends, we decided that we were not going to approach our battles with infertility any differently than we had approached our battles with depression or anxiety or supporting mental health awareness. And we decided to be really open about our journey on social media and in our circles and with our friends. And that really changed how we dealt with the whole process.
So with that, it's not a case where we, being open and the communication that we've had around IVF and our IVF journey, which is specific to us again. So again, we're not experts, but this is the journey as we've experienced it.
Yes.
And that it ends up being the, you know, one of the most helpful tools we have, hence the reason for this podcast. But it is something where you can still treat those stories and treat the journey and the experience of the individual with compassion, but you can still also treat it with frankness, openness, and transparency and truth to bring it to the situation so that it's not something that has to be said behind someone's back, behind right. closed doors, exactly. or muffled over a shoulder or something.
Exactly. And in the same, I mean, my philosophy has been that, like, in the same way that having depression and having anxiety is not my fault, it's not something that I did wrong or asked for or created. And I don't hide the fact that I take an antidepressant every day, that I have anxiety medication available to me, that I'm in counseling regularly. I'm very, like, those are things I'm open to sharing. I felt like the same way, especially, you know, the injection schedule is very rigorous when you do something like IVF, and we would be at dinner with friends and we'd have to leave the table to do injections, or we couldn't leave the house until the injection was done. Like, all of our scheduling for months and months was around these shots.
And it was interesting for us this summer too, because I had also, predating some of this, signed up for a Tough Mudder, right. and I started doing essentially half marathon training over the course of the summer, whereas previous to this, the longest I'd ever run at one time was 4 miles. So now doing a 10-mile Tough Mudder and signing up for training prior to knowing the schedule of our IVF and a lot of the injections, and having a pretty kind of middle of the road but still yet rigorous half marathon training schedule, and figuring out when I could go run 8 miles on a given night, but then have it be done either before or after we had certain shots was very interesting. And or then basically having a RE appointment on a weekend morning and having to get in, you know, 10 miles before that. And so, you know, going out basically before and start running before the sun was up.
It was a really good exercise in communication for us, because these were things, like, we both had our own agendas, but then we had things that had to be done twice daily with each other that were maybe not time or clock negotiable. And I feel like, although it was a very, very difficult physical and mental process, that was something that I was grateful for, was that this is the type of communication that we have to have as parents, and we had a lot of time to practice it.
And in the spirit of some of that communication, we had how many shots?
We did a total of 148 injections between July 25th and November 7th.
So that was a mixture of both subcutaneous and intramuscular. So the majority of the subcutaneous being the initial stims and retrievals and things. And then so...
Yeah, the first 13 days were subcutaneous injections, and everything after that was intramuscular.
And so I didn't lead on initially when we started the intramuscular stuff, but being a 6 foot tall, 225 pound gentleman who's played sports the majority of my life. I'm not really queasy at blood. I have multiple tattoos all over my body. You've had multiple tattoos since we've gotten together, but it is something where the first time we went into the bathroom and we put that intramuscular needle together, my knees were weak.
Oh man, you guys, those needles were like the entire length of my thumb.
I did not know how we were going to do 100 plus of those injections. And so I'm glad the first one went well, because even I think my knuckles were a little weak at that time. But I mean, it was something where you were a champ, you were a trooper. We, you know, researched what we could. You researched what you could to figure out how to make them less painful, make sure we weren't doing scar tissue where we could prevent it, and just make it as easy as possible. And so it was just a matter of some nights they, you know, hurt like hell, but then just getting that ball rolling and just, you know, not having any other way. If we're doing this, we're doing this. I mean,
that saying that, like, if you want something, you'll do whatever it takes to get it. Like, so true, guys. Also, I think the thing with infertility that really caught me off guard emotionally was that, let's be honest, like, up until we were ready to get pregnant, like, my whole previous life had been about not getting pregnant and, like, you know, how anyone can accidentally get pregnant. And then I felt so frustrated that this thing that my body was supposed to do naturally on its own, that people accidentally in high school or college, when they weren't ready or weren't prepared, you know, could do, wasn't something that I was able to do. All I wanted to do was, you know, become a mother and be a good wife and provide you a child and provide myself a child. And the feeling of failure was huge. And so those injections were horrific. I couldn't sit on my behind for like literally 3 months because it was so sore. These injections were also two times a day, not just once. But that was the only thing that I could take charge of. It was the only thing that I could do to change the situation. And so it wasn't ever a question for me.
And so before we jump into the hard cap piece, since you just mentioned, you know, starting the majority of this IVF journey a couple weeks after our initial hard camp visit, I think hard camp, the empowerment there, and then just being open and transparent with our journeys led us to a pretty beautiful situation or a pretty beautiful encounter a couple of weeks ago.
It did.
Where we randomly met someone IRL, you know, in real life.
At a holiday trade show.
That had encountered our pregnancy announcement on Instagram through you tagging it with IVF specific.
Yeah, a friend of hers had sent her our post, and she said, I remember when I saw it, I was in the bathtub and I started crying because your story was so powerful and it was so beautiful. She goes, I can't believe that I'm meeting you in real life. Like, you guys, all I've ever wanted in sharing my story was to make a difference, to make someone else feel less alone, to feel like if I've gone through it, then I can help other people. And that moment was like the coolest moment of my current life.
So here we are standing in the middle of Merch Mart for our Chicago Aware listeners, and in the middle of this awesome display booth, and you and the proprietor or vendor are sitting there crying. I'm trying to hold back tears, but it was just something where, again, that is something that brings power to our stories and the reason why we share them. And the reason for this podcast, the reason why we're so open about everything that we do, the reason why we're advocates, because again, we're not going through our stories alone.
Right.
And, you know, the more we talk about them, the more power and light and shine and strength we have in them. So, totally. So that, let's put a button on kind of the journey. That was a lot, but also, you know, pretty comprehensive as well, and jump into a hard camp. And you mentioned Trite Love and getting connected back in the MySpace days, but I mean, when did you first hear about Hard Camp? And then,
so for those of you who don't know me intimately, my social media preference of choice is Instagram, and I spend a quality amount of time with it on the daily. And so ever since Trite Love in Her Arms and Jamie Tworkowski had pages, I have followed them, and like, I think religiously would be a fair word to use. And I remember it was right around Thanksgiving last year, and Jamie started posting these like sneak peeks about something coming, and I was like, whatever this is, I'm doing it. Like, I literally don't even care. And I remember the night it was announced, and we like sat down and talked about it, and we were like, I was like, I have to go to Hurricane. Like, I don't know what this is, but like, I have to go. And it was never a question to me. You know, my thing was that, again, if you don't know me, the book, If You Feel Too Much, is something that I consider as like my Bible, as my personal like source of comfort and inspiration. I read it probably 35 times easy. We use text from it in our wedding ceremony. The flowers in my bouquet were made from pages of the book. Like I have gifted the book to probably 36 people. My point is that Jamie has a gift in a huge way with words that is incredibly impactful to me. And my hope was that it would prompt me to write again. As Rick mentioned, I have written in the past. I did publish a book several years ago and used to blog religiously, used to journal a lot, and kind of just had lost my way from that over a couple of years. And my hope with going to Heart Camp was that it would revive me to write. That was literally my only hope. I had no expectations. I had no, like, I need to get something out of this. Like, I was going because it was Jamie and because I thought maybe I could get some inspiration.
But it was also something you left out there is, even though maybe inside it was something that was an initial yes, okay, and this was something where we needed to figure out a little bit more. We were, again, in a season where we were trying to start a family. Nothing was coming up there. Recently married, recently out of the traumatic hospital situation, which we talked about.
Yeah.
And so it was something where you wanted to go, but it was also something where...
But I couldn't articulate it to you.
But you felt guilty because it was something you needed to do for you. And where
at the
you
time,
were going,
you weren't interested in it. And I felt like if we weren't going to do it together, then I didn't need to do it.
Exactly. So it was something where that started to kind of stem into other parts of our interaction and conversation and planning and things like that.
Yeah.
So then
right.
It was something where eventually we had to sit down and say, is this something you want to do? Point blank, yes or no? No. I mean, it's a binary question, yes or no. And then so when it was, you know, as distilled as possible, the answer was yes.
Yeah.
Then we figured out how to do it, because that's another theme through almost every episode that we've had so far, is Heart Camp was something based off of bringing your heart to work, authenticity in a period of transition, et cetera, that people needed to do for themselves.
Right. I think I couldn't explain like why I wanted or needed to go was a gut feeling. It wasn't like a rational thing I could talk through, which made me feel like less solid in my request. And like, since it was our money and our time and our vacation and whatever, it didn't just affect me. And since it was something that you were, you know, not sure was for you at the time, I felt like I didn't deserve to go because of this gut feeling I had, and like because I couldn't put a tangible reason on why I wanted to go.
But again, I'm glad we had that conversation.
Oh,
and again, over communicated it.
Yeah.
To the point where it was something for you, but still I was able to support you in that. And we were able to figure out what that meant for both of us. And then seeing what it grew into, and the conversation and more that we'll touch on in my interview when we flip the script and literally switch spots on the couch here, where that sense of community is what drew me in almost instantly, but it just wasn't something I was aware of from the get-go, from all of Jamie's sneak
peeks. Well, and neither was I. I mean, we've talked about this 100 times. When we left Heart Camp, I felt so baffled because I never thought about making friends at Heart Camp. Like, that just wasn't even in my brain.
You were going for the points that Jamie set up.
Yeah, and for, like, my own development. Like, I never thought about the other people in the room, and that was clearly my biggest mistake.
In the best way possible. Yeah. Is there anything that you'd want to say about Heart Camp that we haven't covered or touched on yet, or anything that you haven't heard in any of the interviews we've done so far that you've heard?
I mean, and I was just talking to one of my Heart Camp friends about this last week, but the best thing that I can say is that, you know, so when I did Heart Camp, it was a Sunday night dinner, Monday experience. And we got into town on Saturday, and, you know, there was a small group of us that went to dinner and hung out for a couple hours before, you know, the day started Sunday. And Sunday night when we were at dinner, you know, we were only halfway through Heart Camp, and I was sitting at a table with people I didn't really know, but like had no problem just like opening up to, and I was listening to all these stories. And I just realized, like, these are all people who are cut from the same cloth as me. Like, they might be people who've watched very different life stories or who are in very different places in their life. But, like, we all showed up basically because we believed in Jamie and we believed in Try Love in Her Arms. And everyone had that sort of empathetic heart. And that created a safe place. And I feel like that's the thing, is that the people that I met, the people that I became friends with, the people that were closest to, like people that in the real life, like in the real world, we maybe not wouldn't have gravitated towards, but there are people who are cut from exactly the same cloth as us and have the same heart, the same intentions, the same, you know, wanting to support people's spirit. And that is something that I've never quite felt before in any other. I mean, I've been in a lot of rooms and a lot of organizations and a lot of groups with other people. And while you might have a common interest or priority, being cut from the same cloth is a totally different level. And that was a really cool, it continues to be a really cool experience to me. And it continues to make me want to be like, it drives me towards these people in any capacity.
And it's been interesting to see, as we will jump into kind of the next topic, but it's interesting to see when you mention cut from the same cloth, because it's the same heart, the same intentions, the same motivations, and a lot of overlap in personality and experience and motivation, where, again, like you said, it may not be somebody we would have come in contact with, or just generally through the sheer happenstance of having X many billion people on this earth. Yeah. But it is something where eventually we overlapped and found ourselves in this place where a lot of us are like, well, we're really the same person type thing. And so being able to find that and have those discussions and have a lot of the friendships and the connections blossom, you know, almost inseparable for some folks, to see that has been great.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I mentioned the next topic being the Enneagram, and that's something where in a lot of what we've talked about so far, I think it's probably been of the people that are knowledgeable for the Enneagram that have been guests so far, more of them than not have been twos. And it's also not unfounded, based on if anybody here listening is a betting person, based off of paying attention to the early part of Amanda's story, you would pretty much be spot on, or you will be able to go collect your money if you put your money on the fact that she was a two as well, or is a two as well.
We are both twos.
So do you know which wing you are, or do you remember?
Yeah, I'm a two wing three.
Okay, so that's the same thing. Because you're wing. Here. No, I'm a wing three as well. Like 80% sure I'm a two wing three. I end up having some movement into the wing one stuff, but we generally only touch on the nine basic personality traits of the Enneagram, because there are, with the wings, you end up having subtypes and up to like 27 subtypes and everything, and that just becomes wholly ununderstandable or ungrokkable. But it is something where the nine types are very sufficient in and of themselves, but the two wing three is something where us coming together and understanding that and having more insight together has been so helpful, and in my opinion, has been so helpful in our relationship and our life. Yeah. And how we deal with friends, how we deal with family, how we deal with general interactions at the store. But it's also very insightful into the different ways that we interact in a random situation.
Yeah.
We will want the same things, and it will affect us the same way, but we also generally attack it or approach it, to use, you know, a less violent term, a little bit differently. And so it's interesting to see how, even though we stack up on pretty much almost all of the same kind of question marks, there's still a lot of room for movement inside there.
And you can cut this part out if you want to, but the moment in which I acknowledged that the most was the night of the 2016 presidential election, because we obviously felt the same way about the situation. And when the results were called, I cried. I was devastated. You were pissed off and angry, and you wanted to punch it. And that was the first time that I was like, wow, we feel different things. Our emotions are different, even though we feel the same about the situation. That was very insightful to me on like how we each handled the emotional component of it, and some of the ways that we have moved, like that we have in the time since then, handled things where we are walking through the same season, the same situation, and how we process our feelings.
And then in the flip side of that, there are certain situations when, in dealing with a lot of your chronic illness and the ineptitude that is the healthcare system, yes, there are times when you go to 11 rather quickly.
Absolutely.
Just based off of...
Because I'm starting at like a 6.5.
Yeah, because it ends up being a case where this is the 19th time you've called, yeah, and you're talking to the 19th different person, and, you know, we're getting rebuilt again for a $15,000 treatment when it shouldn't be, and et cetera, et cetera. So you tend to go that way very quickly, as opposed to if I can jump in and be act as a
you're
reserve.
You're able to stay more rational.
Or be the airport guy with the two glowing orange things directing you to a certain outcome.
I definitely...
To navigate that.
I've always been emotional heavy, but when it comes to things that, especially things that I cannot control but that are affecting me, like yes, a $300,000 bill per se, I really struggle with how to communicate because my emotions become really big really quickly.
And I think that's pretty common in the I believe it's the 2-3-4 space in the Enneagram. Is called the heart space. So I believe that that's, you know, not unheard of there in any way, shape, or form. So we can start touching on some of the other buzzwords that's extending from mental health, but self-care. Usually, like, we've touched on a lot of stereotypical or prototypical self-care formats, but as one of my favorite clips from season 2 has been Brit, or sorry, season 1 has been Brit saying, if bubble baths and champagne are your thing for self-care, go for it. But due to the, I would almost think Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom amount of bath bomb boulders we have underneath our sink, bubble baths and bath bombs aren't going to come up here.
I want to interrupt you because the quote, there's a quote from a Thought Catalog article, which I repeatedly repost because I truly believe in it. But it basically says, true self-care is not salt baths and chocolate cake. It's making the choice to build a life you don't need to regularly escape from. And that is so true because, yeah, I can throw out a whole bunch of keywords like get your nails done, get a massage, go get a facial, go buy new makeup, go buy new clothes, go download music, go to a movie. But like those are distractions, and while distractions are often a great thing and I'm very pro them, it's not really care. And this Thought Catalog article, which was written, this one was updated very recently, but it's off, self-care is often an unbeautiful thing. It's like making a spreadsheet of your debt. It's keeping a morning routine. It's drinking enough water. It's sweating through another workout, breaking up with a toxic friend. It's doing things that look at the spaces in your life that aren't comfortable or that aren't supporting you and your goals and your dreams, and it's working through the ugly parts of them in order to get to the other side.
And that's where I think some of the differentiation in our personality types comes in as well, where that was something in our relationship that I had to learn your perspective and approach to self-care, and you had to understand mine.
Yeah.
Where yours, just over the course of your journey, generally becomes...
Well, mine has changed. Before we lived together, my self-care was always reorganizing my drawers. I would empty all of my drawers out, throw shit away, and reorganize them. That was like the thing that I could control.
Well, and more recently, it's been around solitude, calm, withdrawing, things like that. Whereas for me, it's a busy calendar, bringing people together, being active. And so those obviously are at two different ends of the spectrum.
Yeah, that's so true.
Being in a season where we generally need a lot of self-care, it's been an interesting balancing act to figure that all out. But it is something where the communication is paramount.
Yeah. Well, and I think too, we've lived together long enough that we just understand off the bat and respect that like your self-care is more extroverted and my self-care is more introverted. And I don't think, I think that we both know how to utilize self-care to the best of our needs in the time that we need it. But I think that we also keep tabs on each other's self-care and like when, like, cause I will say to you sometimes, like you have too much on the calendar. Like I understand what you're trying to do, but like slow down. Mm-hmm. And you'll say the same thing to me. Like you've been in the house for 6 days. Like, can we go outside? And I think that that's really important too, is like keeping a balance of someone who knows you and understands your process. And it, you also know and truly believe that they have your best interests in mind.
Absolutely. One of the kind of through threads that we've had through there and through Heart Camp, and even you didn't really touch on it early on in some of the health stuff that you mentioned, was the notion or need for community. And early on, and you've had a you know, a bumpy ride with some of that early on with the larger community as a whole, with the Crones and the GI community at large. But since then, you know, coming into more of the general mental health community, Heart Camp, and now even the IVF community, and seeing the benefits of that, how has community impacted your journey? What does it mean to you?
I feel like I've had various types of community for the majority of my life. You know, the first thing I really think about is when I skated competitively, I, for several years, was with the same people in the same place doing the same thing. And that was my community. Those were the people I hung out with. Those were the people whose parents took care of me when my parents couldn't, you know. And then I think about when I was in high school and I was on the yearbook staff, and that was my community. And then I went to college and I lived in a sorority house, and that was my community. And I think that in those years, community to me was always defined as like the people who do what you do, who like what you like, believe what you believe, support you, like work in the same space as you. And I think
community by context almost.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that in the last couple of years, I had to go through some more toxic and unhelpful communities. Like you mentioned the IBD community. I also will admit to the fact that when I did my IOP program, I broke their most important rule, which was don't make friends outside of this room. How would I make you all my best friends? Because that's how much my empathy is big. But like, again, these were all people who are like working on very specific things, and I wanted to carry all of their burdens. And it just, I put myself in a lot of really toxic situations that I couldn't see at the time. And I think in the last probably like 2-3 years, the communities that I've put myself in have been more about intention and practice rather than commonality. So being in a community of people who are writers, like I did an intensive writing course with Hannah Brencher, and I'm in a group of people who were in that writing course who have similar writing goals. Being in the Heart Camp community and being in the mental health awareness community, being in the fertility community, being in communities in which your intentions, in your heart, in your actions are kind of working towards whatever your goal is, even if it's not the same goal as someone else, it's the same type of pathway. And that has felt like a lot truer of community for me. But my experience overall has made me realize that it's important to be mindful of and selective of the communities that you choose to stay in once you really get a feel for what's happening, who's there, and how it makes you feel. You have a choice to leave. Even if it's uncomfortable, it's definitely better than staying. So I think that that is my most important advice when it comes to finding the right communities to be a part of, is that it's okay to be selective and that you should be making choices because it's your heart and your well-being at stake.
And that, as you were saying that, there was a couple more lines from other episodes that we've done that started hitting me in the back of the head like a Nerf bat. But like the biggest one was one that we closed on with episode 3 of the first season with Jen John, where she says, or she details the idea of post-traumatic growth. And that seems to be exactly that, where, again, everything that we detailed in your story at the beginning, you know, you're put into a similar situation, but now you have different trained reactions, you have a different set of tools, you have a different fight or flight nature, and you react and you thrive and you handle those situations much differently.
Well, and it's just interesting to think about like the person that I was 4 years ago, the person that I was 8 years ago, the person that I was 15 years ago, like those other versions of Amanda would not fit into the communities that I'm a part of now because my coping mechanisms were different and my strategies were different and the way that I process things was different and my end goal was different. And so I think that that's really important too, is that as you grow and as you learn your heart and your ways and what feels good and what doesn't, like that you continually put yourself in places that feel good for you and not places that you feel obligated to be in.
So let's start to wrap up here. So A, we can take another bathroom break. B, we can check to see what Ollie is barking on. But if there's one thing that someone can take away from your story that you shared with us here and just in the larger spectrum of things, what would you want that to be? And it can't be that you're funnier since you're pregnant.
But you guys, I really am. You know, I think there are two things that come to mind. You asked me to pick one, but I don't actually care. there are two things that come to mind. The first is that if you had seen me from the outside prior to my entering the IOP program, you would have been like, there's no way that that girl is depressed. Like, she has it all going for her. She blah, 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 blah. Like, anybody can fake it. And that's the thing is, like, if you are like, I'm such a good faker, like, no one needs to know that I have stuff going on. Like, that's cool. Keep faking it on the outside. But, like, tell someone the truth still, because it's really important. And then you will realize that you actually might be happier and more comfortable when you stop faking it. But again, like, that takes lots of time, and that's okay. And the other thing is that it's gonna take time. Like, when I started the IOP program, I was like, okay, like, 3 weeks and I'm like a new person, I'm never gonna be depressed again. LOL, JK, that's not how this works. It's been 5 years since I graduated that program, and I still see a therapist every single week, because guess what? It's so good for me. It's so important to my development, and I continually benefit from being able to talk through things and work through things. And some weeks are light and fluffy and we talk about, you know, stupid things, and other weeks we talk about, you know, 10-year revelations. But that's the thing, is like, keep trying. Like, you might be like, oh, well, I saw a therapist and it like didn't get me anywhere. Okay, well, maybe that wasn't the right relationship or the right person to help you feel comfortable. Or maybe I tried an antidepressant, but I didn't like the side effects. Well, guess what? There's like 56 of them. And sometimes it takes a long time. I mean, I was on several different antidepressants. I was on combinations of antidepressants. And it took a long time to figure out what the right medication was for me and what the right dosage was for me. And even now, in the last 16 months, when I went through a really hard season, we increased the dose because I needed a little extra coping, a little extra support to get through some things. And then when I felt like things had leveled back out again, we went back to my regular dose. And so I think that's also a really big thing, is that, like, give yourself permission or grace or understanding to continually adjust. And I know that it's really hard, especially when you are facing depression or anxiety or mental illness in any kind. You may feel like you don't have any energy left. You may feel like your head is up against a wall. And honestly, that's the best time to tell a friend, to reach out to someone who maybe you don't even know that well, but something about them says that they will hear you. It's not always about finding someone who will understand, per se, or someone who will carry your secret. It's about someone who will hear you, because when they hear you, they will help you get to the next step in the next part.
It's about somebody finding someone who will act as a bridge to get you to where you need to be, not necessarily somebody who's going to fix it for you.
Yes, exactly. Because coming from someone who tried to be a fixer for a lot of years, and someone who looked for a fixer for a lot of years, that's not how you grow. It's not how you work through things, because guess what? For any of us who've gotten to where we've gotten mental health wise, where we've said, I need help or something isn't right, there's a lot of stuff to work through. And that is totally normal. That's where we've all been. But you have to give yourself the chance to go through and sort through in categories and understand the things that brought you to that place, so they don't keep you in that place.
What is your one favorite song that could be happy time, self-care? It cannot be the entire Jock Jams playlist.
Okay, well, that's like just my morning pump up playlist. Okay, good. I have two. So my first one is definitely more of like a sometimes song, but it's like my go-to recharger song. It's Fight Song by Rachel Platten. I really hope it's not already on the playlist, because that's like my favorite, like, lines are, this is my fight song, take back my life song, prove I'm all right song. And that just always, like, I really like to drive and turn that up and just like scream to it on the radio. And the other song is Scars to Your Beautiful by Alessia Cara. And that's when the very first time I heard it on the radio, I like stopped me in my tracks, because I have physical scars from medical procedures and surgeries and other things that I've gone through. I have emotional scars, and I feel scarred in my soul and things that I've gone through and experienced. And this song just really, really spoke to me about, like, the ways that you can show that your scars are beautiful, or the ways that you can feel like your scars are beautiful. Mm-hmm.
Thank you so very much for joining us this week. We hope you had as good a time listening as we had recording the interview. Don't forget to check out anthologiesofhope.com/playlist for all the awesome songs that will get added each week. You can find us on social media at Anthologies of Hope on Facebook and Instagram, and Anthologies Pod on Twitter. It would be great if you could subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or Google, and leave us a review. As always, remember, everyone has a story, and it's about time we start listening.